Chapter 6. All the morning Nostromo had kept his eye from afar on the Casa Viola, even in the thick of the hottest scrimmage near the custom house. If I see smoke rising over there, he thought to himself, they are lost. Directly the mob had broken, he pressed with a small band of Italian workmen in that direction, which, indeed, was the shortest line towards the town. That part of the rabble he was pursuing seemed to think of making a stand under the house. A volley fired by his followers from behind an aloe hedge made the rascals fly. In a gap chopped out for the rails of the harbor branch line, Nostromo appeared, mounted on his silver-gray mare. He shouted, sent after them one shot from his revolver, and galloped up to the cafe window. He had an idea that old Giorgio would choose that part of the house for a refuge. His voice had penetrated to them, sounding breathlessly hurried. Hola, Vecchio. Oh, Vecchio. Is it all well with you in there? You see, murmured old Viola to his wife. Signora Teresa was silent now. Outside, Nostromo laughed. I can hear the padrona is not dead. You have done your best to kill me with fear, cried Signora Teresa. She wanted to say something more, but her voice failed her. Linda raised her eyes to her face for a moment, but old Giorgio shouted apologetically, she is a little upset. Outside, Nostromo shouted back with another laugh, she cannot upset me. Signora Teresa found her voice. It is what I say. You have no heart and you have no conscience. Guy and Batista, they heard him wheel his horse away from the shutters. The party he led were babbling excitedly in Italian and Spanish, inciting each other to the pursuit. He put himself at their head, crying, Avanti! He has not stopped very long with us. There is no praise from strangers to be got here, Signora Teresa said tragically. Avanti! Yes. That is all he cares for. To be first somewhere somehow, to be first with these English. They will be showing him to everybody. This is our Nostromo. She laughed ominously. W, what a name. What is that? Nostromo? He would take a name, that is properly no word from them. Meantime Giorgio, with tranquil movements, had been unfastening the door. The flood of light fell on Signora Teresa, with her two girls gathered to her side, a picturesque woman in a pose of maternal exultation. Behind her the wall was dazzlingly white, and the crude colors of the Garibaldi lithograph paled in the sunshine. Old Viola, at the door, moved his arm upwards, as if referring all his quick, fleeting thoughts to the picture of his old chief on the wall. Even when he was cooking for the ignorant Inglesi engineers, he was a famous cook. Though the kitchen was a dark place, he was, as it were, under the eye of the great man who had led him in a glorious struggle where, under the walls of Gita, tyranny would have expired forever had it not been for that accursed Piedmontese race of kings and ministers. When sometimes a frying pan caught fire during a delicate operation with some shredded onions, and the old man was seen backing out of the doorway, swearing, and coughing violently in an acrid cloud of smoke, the name of Caver the arch-intriguer sold to kings and tyrants could be heard involved in imprecations against the China girls, cooking in general, and the brute of a country, where he was reduced to live for the love of liberty, that traitor had strangled. Then Signora Teresa, all in black, issuing from another door, advanced, portly and anxious, inclining her fine, black-browed head, opening her arms, and crying in a profound tone, Giorgio, thou passionate man, misericordia divina, in the sun like this, he will make himself ill. At her feet the hens made off in all directions, with immense strides. If there were any engineers from up the line staying in Sulaco, a young English face or two would appear at the billiard room occupying one end of the house. But at the other end, in the cafe, Luis, the mulatto, took good care not to show himself. The Indian girls, with hair like flowing black manes, undressed only in a shift and short petticoat, stared dully from under the square-cut fringes on their foreheads. The noisy frizzling of fat had stopped, the fumes floated upwards in sunshine, a strong smell of burnt onions hung in the drowsy heat, enveloping the house, and the eye lost itself in a vast flat expanse of grass to the west, as if the plain between the Sierra overtopping Sulaco and the coast range away there towards Esmeralda had been as big as half the world. Signora Teresa, after an impressive pause, remonstrated, "Hey, Giorgio, leave Caver alone, and take care of yourself. Now we are lost in this country all alone with the two children, because you cannot live under a king." And while she looked at him, she would sometimes put her hand hastily to her side with a short twitch of her fine lips, and a knitting of her black, straight eyebrows like a flicker of angry pain, or an angry thought on her handsome regular features. It was pain. She suppressed the twinge. It had come to her first a few years, after they had left Italy, to emigrate to America and settle at last in Sulaco, after wandering from town to town, trying shopkeeping in a small way here and there, and once an organized enterprise of fishing in Maldonado for Giorgio, like the great Garibaldi, had been a sailor in his time. Sometimes he had no patience with pain. For years its gnawing had been part of the landscape, embracing the glitter of the harbor under the wooded spurs of the range, and the sunshine itself was heavy, and dull heavy with pain, not like the sunshine of her girlhood, in which middle-aged Giorgio had wooed her gravely and passionately on the shores of the Gulf of Spezia. "You go in at once, Giorgio," she directed. "Oh, one would think you do not wish to have any pity on me with four Signora Inglesi staying in the house." "Vi Virginia Bean, va bean," Giorgio would mutter. He obeyed. "The Signora Inglesi would require their midday meal presently." He had been one of the immortal and invincible band of liberators who had made the mercenaries of tyranny fly like chaff before a hurricane, un uragano terribile. But that was before he was married and had children, and before tyranny had reared its head again amongst the traitors who had imprisoned Garibaldi, his hero. There were three doors in the front of the house, and each afternoon the Garibaldino could be seen at one or another of them with his big bush of white hair, his arms folded, his legs crossed, leaning back his leonine head against the side, and looking up the wooded slopes of the foothills at the snowy dome of Higuerota. The front of his house threw off a black long rectangle of shade, broadening slowly over the soft ox cart track. Through the gaps, chopped out in the yonder hedges, the harbor branch railway, laid out temporarily on the level of the plain, curved away its shining parallel ribbons on a belt of scorched and withered grass within 60 yards of the end of the house. In the evening the empty material trains of flat cars circled round the dark green grove of Sulaco, and ran, undulating slightly with white jets of steam, over the plain towards the Casa Viola, on their way to the railway yards by the harbor. The Italian driver saluted him from the footplate with raised hand, while the Negro brakesman sat carelessly on the brakes, looking straight forward, with the rims of their big hats flapping in the wind. In return, Giorgio would give a slight sideways jerk of the head, without unfolding his arms. On this memorable day of the riot, his arms were not folded on his chest. His hand grasped the barrel of the gun grounded on the threshold. He did not look up once at the white dome of Higuerota, whose cool purity seemed to hold itself aloof from a hot earth. His eyes examined the plain curiously. Tall trails of dust subsided here and there. In a speckless sky the sun hung clear and blinding. Knots of men ran headlong, others made a stand, and the irregular rattle of firearms came rippling to his ears in the fiery, still air. Single figures on foot raced desperately. Horsemen galloped towards each other, wheeled round together, separated at speed. Giorgio saw one fall, rider and horse disappearing, as if they had galloped into a chasm, and the movements of the animated scene were like the passages of a violent game played upon the plain by dwarfs mounted and on foot, yelling with tiny throats, under the mountain that seemed a colossal embodiment of silence. Never before had Giorgio seen this bit of plain so full of active life. His gaze could not take in all its details at once. He shaded his eyes with his hand, till suddenly the thundering of many hoofs nearby startled him. A troop of horses had broken out of the fenced paddock of the railway company. They came on like a whirlwind, and dashed over the line snorting, kicking, squealing in a compact, peopled, tossing mob of bay, brown, gray backs, eyes staring, necks extended, nostrils red, long tails streaming. As soon as they had leaped upon the road, the thick dust flew upwards from under their hoofs, and within 6 yards of Giorgio only a brown cloud with vague forms of necks and cruppers rolled by, making the soil tremble on its passage. Viola coughed, turning his face away from the dust, and shaking his head slightly. There will be some horse catching to be done before tonight, he muttered. In the square of sunlight falling through the door, Signora Teresa, kneeling before the chair, had bowed her head, heavy with a twisted mass of ebony hair streaked with silver, into the palm of her hands. The black lace shawl she used to drape about her face had dropped to the ground by her side. The two girls had got up, hand in hand, in short skirts, their loose hair falling in disorder. The younger had thrown her arm across her eyes, as if afraid to face the light. Linda, with her hand on the other's shoulder, stared fearlessly. Viola looked at his children. The sun brought out the deep lines on his face, and, energetic in expression, it had the immobility of a carving. It was impossible to discover what he thought. Bushy gray eyebrows shaded his dark glance. Well, and do you not pray like your mother? Linda pouted, advancing her red lips, which were almost too red. But as he had admirable eyes, brown, with a sparkle of gold in the irises, full of intelligence and meaning, and so clear, that they seemed to throw a glow upon her thin, colorless face. There were bronze glints in the somber clusters of her hair, and the eyelashes, long and coal black, made her complexion appear still more pale. Mother is going to offer up a lot of candles in the church. She always does when Nostromo has been away fighting. I shall have some to carry up to the chapel of the Madonna in the cathedral. She said all this quickly, with great assurance, in an animated, penetrating voice. Then, giving her sister's shoulder a slight shake, she added, and she will be made to carry one too. Why made? Inquired Giorgio, gravely. Does she not want to? She is timid, said Linda, with a little burst of laughter. People notice her fair hair as she goes along with us. They call out after her, look at the Rubia. Look at the Rubiacita. Apostrophe they call out in the streets. She is timid. And you? You are not timid, eh? The father pronounced, slowly. She tossed back all her dark hair. Nobody calls out after me. Old Giorgio contemplated his children thoughtfully. There was 2 years' difference between them. They had been born to him late, years after the boy had died. Had he lived, he would have been nearly as old as Gian Battista, whom the English called Nostromo. But as to his daughters, the severity of his temper, his advancing age, his absorption in his memories, had prevented his taking much notice of them. He loved his children. But girls belong more to the mother, and much of his affection had been expended in the worship and service of liberty. When quite a youth, he had deserted from a ship trading to La Plata to enlist in the navy of Montevideo, then under the command of Garibaldi. Afterwards, in the Italian Legion of the Republic struggling against the encroaching tyranny of Rosas, he had taken part, on great plains, on the banks of immense rivers, in the fiercest fighting perhaps the world had ever known. He had lived amongst men who had declaimed about liberty, suffered for liberty, died for liberty, with a desperate exultation, and with their eyes turned towards an oppressed Italy. His own enthusiasm had been fed on scenes of carnage, on the examples of lofty devotion, on the din of armed struggle, on the inflamed language of proclamations. He had never parted from the chief of his choice, the fiery apostle of independence, keeping by his side in America and in Italy till after the fatal day of Aspromonte, when the treachery of kings, emperors, and ministers had been revealed to the world in the wounding and imprisonment of his hero, a catastrophe that had instilled into him a gloomy doubt of ever being able to understand the ways of divine justice. He did not deny it, however. It required patience, he would say. Though he disliked priests, and would not put his foot inside a church for anything, he believed in God. Were not the proclamations against tyrants addressed to the peoples, in the name of God and liberty? Odd for men, religions for women, he muttered sometimes. In Sicily, an Englishman who had turned up in Palermo after its evacuation by the army of the king, had given him a Bible in Italian, the publication of the British and Foreign Bible Society, bound in a dark leather cover. In periods of political adversity, in the pauses of silence, when the revolutionists issued no proclamations, Giorgio earned his living with the first work that came to hand, as sailor, as dock laborer on the quays of Genoa, once as a hand on a farm in the hills above Spezia, and in his spare time he studied the thick volume. He carried it with him in two battles. Now it was his only reading, and in order not to be deprived of it, the print was small, he had consented to accept the present of a pair of silver-mounted spectacles from Signora Emilia Gould, the wife of the Englishman who managed the silver mine in the mountains 3 leagues from the town. She was the only Englishwoman in Sulaco. Giorgio Viola had a great consideration for the English. This feeling, born on the battlefields of Uruguay, was 40 years old at the very least. Several of them had poured their blood for the cause of freedom in America, and the first he had ever known he remembered by the name of Samuel. He commanded a Negro company under Garibaldi, during the famous siege of Montevideo, and died heroically with his Negroes at the fording of the Boyana. He, Giorgio, had reached the rank of ensign alferez and cooked for the general. Later, in Italy, he, with the rank of lieutenant. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.